It's the fourth day of long lines and dry pumps in Britain, and the army's preparing to help with a fuel supply problem. The rise in demand came amid fears of a driver shortage hitting fuel supply. The UK is said to be short of 100,000 truck drivers, causing problems for food suppliers and supermarkets. Now, this is said to be the result of new Brexit visa regulations and also a COVID backlog. Now, let's go to London to our own Amina Taylor, and let's hear her tell us about the situation there. Amina, over to you.
Well, unfortunately, it would have been another worrying day for consumers as they perhaps worried about how they might get to work, to school, and go about their daily lives tomorrow. Because despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson making his first on-camera comments about this, saying the situation was returning to some kind of satisfactory levels and that consumers must go about their petrol filling business in the normal way in order to help regulate the supplies at the pumps, the Petrol Retailers Association, that's the main group who looks after four courts here, who represent those members, say still nearly 40% of their four courts are empty. Now, if you extrapolate from the information, even if you can find a place with a long line, you're actually in the minority here because a lot of the petrol pumps are running dry. When I filed my story on this yesterday, we drove to six places hoping to speak to people in those long lines, and there were none because the forecourts were empty. So Grant Shapps, the transport secretary here, has placed the blame firmly on hauliers, the haulage industry, and also on consumers for panic buying. But I think the messaging coming out of Downing Street and the government might not really be matching the reality on the ground as people see empty forecourts and, of course, long lines if they're lucky enough to see those. This has also very briefly turned into a political situation with Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, saying he would be handling things in a different way, prioritising key workers and extending the visa programme to ensure experienced HGV drivers from across the UK and EU can actually help alleviate the situation.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm Amina Taylor in London. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In this edition, we're discussing the fuel crisis in the UK. To do that, I'll be joined by co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Eric Ward Stewart in London, and filmmaker and activist Ken Farrow, also in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to the show. Let me start with Justin. A fourth day of long lines, Justin, as you heard, and pump closures as prices rise to eight-year highs. And there are instances of violence between angry customers and tensions as tensions are rising. How bad is the situation, in your opinion?
It's been really quite pathetic when you actually see what's happened and how it's been handled. But it does vary hugely across the country. There are some areas where I come across, North Bengal yesterday, and there were very little issues so much there. But other areas, no, it really has been dreadful. And of course, when people are desperate because they need their transport, maybe it's not just for their work, but for medical issues, all sorts of elements, if people cannot get it, and there are queues growing too long, or, as often you'll find with petrol stations, there are two entrances. So you end up immediately with an argument between two queues as to who's getting what. But that, as you were just, Amina was just saying, we've had a distinct lack of political leadership to try and manage our way out of this. This, after all, is nothing new. This was predicted over 18 months ago. And yet we find ourselves in a position where politicians are looking at some surprise, saying, we didn't think this was going to happen. Oh, yes, you did. You just you didn't prepare for it.
Right. Now, our second guest is also joining us, Ken Ferrer, filmmaking activist in London. Good to have you with us, Ken. Boris Johnson's government has announced a series of emergency measures to address the fuel crisis. So how is the fuel crisis being tackled?
Well, it's being tackled quite incompetently, but what we have to remember is that the crisis itself is not just around fuel, it's around the very infrastructure of the United Kingdom that relies on foreign workers, migrant workers, who were told to leave this country. And so I don't think this is just about fuel. This crisis is about the future of this country in terms of its workforce. It has a diminishing workforce, and this is just the first sign of many things to come. So whatever the government does or doesn't do in this situation, it really isn't going to make any difference in the long run until they address the very fundamental nature of work, workers' rights, the rights of workers who come to Britain. And so that has to be the solution. So the solutions in terms of the army and the small number of licenses being offered, and even those are restricted, are just a smokescreen for the bigger issues here, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, Justin, how big a role does Brexit play in this fuel crisis besetting Britain?
I think in many ways it's almost a backdrop to the whole thing. There are many issues which have affected what's happened to this. The pandemic, the pingdemic, as we like to call it, because of the app we have on our phones, also the level of concern, because people have been off on furlough for so long. But Brexit is lurking behind it. Now, let's be fair, there are a shortage of drivers throughout the whole of Europe, very significant numbers indeed. It's almost a generational issue that people don't want to go back to working in really very poor quality in terms of pay and conditions for such a vital issue. What the pandemic brought out was how weak our supply chains were, not just coming from, say, the Far East and the difficulties there because of the pandemic, let alone from the odd ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal. But actually this issue with regard to domestic supply chains, and it's not just about fuel. There's no shortage of fuel at all, but actually making sure the structure is there to make sure food, essential items are being delivered on time. And people's expectations, of course, over the past few years, have said that they expect it there to be immediately. But this is what's so frustrating about what we've seen with this. Brexit has meant that a proportion of the workforce have gone back. And, of course, although the government has come up with a temporary scheme for 3 months, no person in their right mind is going to come back just for 3 months, and they'll probably be told to go home again over the Christmas holiday period. And any politician who's seriously putting that forward as an answer to this is frankly deluded.
Now, Ken, how about COVID-19? You know, coronavirus backlog is also blamed for this fuel problem.
Well, I think the experience of COVID and the way the country fundamentally ground to a halt in terms of economic development acted as a buffer for the impact of Brexit. Now that the country's coming out of COVID and that there's a much more economic activity, people need to start moving around. And so we're beginning to see the impact of the effects of Brexit with this so-called fuel distribution crisis. But also I think we're going to be seeing it in the future in terms of other areas as well. So what essentially happened in COVID is that the country fundamentally shut down to a greater extent. We had stops and starts over different periods, but it didn't really get on its feet in economic terms. And now that we are apparently coming out of COVID and that economic activity is increasing, we have this issue coming up. And I think it's going to the impact of COVID was to act as a buffer to the bad planning, mismanagement, and basically foolish acts of the British government in terms of Brexit.
Okay, Justin, do you share the same view?
Yeah, and Brexit, if you just want a straightforward calculation, you're knocking about 2 billion value off the British economy. Now, billions are one of those numbers that you can't actually, most people can't get their head around. It's a lot of money. And at a time when the economy is supposed to be trying to recover, you've automatically taken away linkage to the largest trading bloc in the world. And this is what is so ridiculous. The largest trading bloc in the world, where Britain was not only a member of, but has significant influence in it as one of the major powers in it. So actually, this has made the EU significantly weaker as well, because Germany is desperate to reform the EU, but as their previous finance minister said, it's all very well trying to reform it, but they can't do that with Luxembourg and Denmark. They need someone with a big budget and political strength to see it through. So the impact also on the EU is there, but I have to say that the bad handling by our politicians with regard to Brexit, ending up with a populist vote for people voting to leave without really understanding the fundamental issues behind all of this.
Well, unfortunately, we lost a connection with Justin. Let me ask you this. Labour has said that the latest response to the fuel crisis is an admission of failure and that asking the army to pitch in is a sticking plaster. Do you have the same opinion?
In a sense, I do. I mean, clearly, it's not a solution to distribution. And, you know, the British government and the army could very, very quickly solve this situation in terms of physical distribution. But I think what's at stake here, there are two issues that we really need to talk about in relation to your question. One is that Labour have consistently failed the rights of migrant workers. And migrant workers are the very group of people who sustain the infrastructure of the country, whether it's to do with food, whether it's to do with transport, whether it's to do with the National Health Service. So they're a very, very important part of that workforce. And of course, Labour have done nothing to support those groups. And even looking at the party conference at the moment, they're doing very little to actually move forward in terms of that. But I think what we're discussing here is basically, you know, we have a capitalist system which has seen a hiccup. But at the same time, out of every crisis, just as we had the kind of corruption that we witnessed with politicians in Britain in terms of providing jobs and contracts to their friends who exploited the situation in terms of COVID, in terms of PPE, and the supply of medical, we're seeing the same things going on now in terms of the petroleum companies who will benefit from this situation. So I think there's a bigger picture here in terms of just discussing about how do we get the country running again? Well, right. What country do we want to have running again? So I think these are important questions.
Okay, Justin, sorry for that technical problem. We lost our connection for a few seconds. Go ahead with your comments.
Yes, so the issue is one of what you find yourself with actually losing your connection with the largest trading bloc in the world is frankly stupid. Because the wealth that actually Britain has acquired since joining the EU was huge, and none of that was properly discussed at the time of the vote. But Britain has benefited when it joined the EU, what was the EEC in those days. It was the poor man of Europe. When we left, we weren't necessarily the richest, but certainly one of the wealthiest, and really seemed to be quite a successful economy, despite many difficult issues and longer-term elements, which Phil has just highlighted there, which weren't being properly addressed in terms of not just low pay, but actually the ability to make sure you've got immigrants coming to work here. Because after all, remember, Britain is an immigrant country. Actually, the entire country is made up of waves upon it, and our success has always been our acceptance of and taking in those people. And we're going to see a lot more of that over the next few years. Bear in mind, we've probably got 300,000 people potentially coming from Hong Kong, which I think will be extremely exciting for Britain. But for the reaction of our politicians, I fear they are far more old-fashioned in their attitudes and more Luddite in their behavior, rather than seeing the economic possibilities that this could create.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, do you believe that the measures the British government has taken are sufficient to tackle the issue? You know, there are some measures like temporarily exempting fuel companies from competition law.
Well, I think out of every crisis, whether it's man-made or whether it's natural, you know, there are elements within the government and within society that exploit that situation. So I think that there's money being made at the moment out of this crisis, and we can see that just on a basic level in terms of people kind of stocking up on fuel and doing a run on fuel, which now becomes more demanding, more in demand and more expensive, right to the top where you have these companies who have no, who are basically told that, well, you can make as much money as you want to at the moment. So I think all of that is going on. I mean, essentially, that we have a capitalist country. We're talking about how to get it running again. And this is not really the most significant issue here. The most significant issue is the mistreatment of working class people, the mistreatment of immigrants and migrants. And ironically, at the very same time, you know, we had people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, coming over, invited after the war to work in the NHS on the buses. And there was the Windrush scandal where some of them were asked to return after decades and decades of being settled in the UK. And the ironic thing is, at the moment, the British government is actually out in Jamaica trying to recruit nurses for the shortfall that we have in the National Health Service. So the crisis on fuel is really part of a much bigger crisis this country is experiencing. And it's something that can only be solved if Britain becomes less insular, and if the people of Britain accept the fact that the reality of the situation is that politically, culturally, economically, Britain is part of the world, it's international, and it needs to behave like that instead of shrinking in and trying to become an island fortress.
Mm-hmm. Justin, let's have your comment on that.
Well, you only have to look back at the history of Britain. We may not necessarily be very proud of colonial periods and things like that, but Britain's been its most successful when it has seen itself as an international country operating internationally, whether that's today in modern financial services and things like that, which of course have been hit by Brexit as well, or in terms of trade, but also in terms of accepting in waves of immigrants who've really benefited the economy. Whether you're going back to the periods of the pogroms of Russia at the turn of the 20th century, or whether you're dealing with people coming from Amin's Uganda, you're seeing people who come here and come into society and added astonishing value to it, not just in terms of economic issues, but also in terms of its culture as well. Unfortunately, you then have, it's very easy to whip up, as it were, protectionist, isolationist views, as you saw with President Trump, to be able to say, put America first. Well, actually, no, that's ridiculous. It's much better when a country like Britain realizes it's an international player, that's what it's always done, and it is at most successful when it is at most open to other people, accepting of their cultures, and being able to actually help the economy. And so we're being very short-sighted, unfortunately, if we're just going to bow and let populist politicians get away with it. That's stupid.
Ken, as you know, the average age of drivers in Britain is 55 years old, and they are retiring, and the industry hasn't made that job attractive either. And the UK needs 100,000 truck drivers. So what's the solution?
Well, the solution is not around 100,000. It's not about average age. None of those issues are as important as the fundamental rights of working class people in this country. So whilst any measures the government puts in or the industry suggests are necessary for them to be able to maintain their distribution, maintain their profit making, really the fundamental questions that should come out of this, people should be asking, you know, what kind of country does Britain want to be? How do people want to live? What kind of society do they want? And what do they want to get out of it beyond the selfishness that we've seen, you know, even in terms of the panic buying over the past 3 or 4 days or week? Essentially, you know, every crisis, as Naomi Klein outlined, you know, has the benefit of some people. There will be always people that benefit from the crisis. So there was no need for this so-called fuel crisis. In fact, it's not even a crisis. You know, it's just an opportunity for the government to reassert its control. And even though they may appear to be, you know, incompetent and stupid and ineffective, they don't really care. The government is making money out of the situation. The government made money out of COVID, and it will continue to make money. People have to remember that this government was voted in and has behaved intolerably since it took power. It's only interested in a very narrow group of people. It's interested in itself out of making money. There's no commitment to community. There's no commitment to the people. And so for people to be asking the government, the very people who have really abused the country since they took power, is, I think, laughable. And I think people should really not think just beyond filling their petrol up in their car, but really what to do beyond that.
Right. Justin, what's the main part of the problem? Is the driver shortage the main part of the problem, or what?
No, it's not. What you've actually got is a huge fragility in terms of the supply system. And when you, as you saw the pandemic, the supply structures were very, very weak indeed. So, you know, people were talking about the impact on holiday presents and such like over a year ago. And this is really before anything to do with truck drivers or anything like that. And bear in mind, the truck drivers issue isn't just a British issue. You've got the same happening throughout Poland, Germany, and other elements. Huge numbers shorting. People have not come back to that work. Why? Well, primarily because over the past two decades, you've had people being able to develop the gig economy. That's to say, you are paid immediately for what you do by the hour with very little social responsibility to your position and how your rights are respected. That is now changing. And those drivers are staying, or those obviously retiring, people not going into this part of the industry because it's not paid well enough. Their services are provided, they're supporting it a very incredibly weak. So why should they bother? There are other things they can go and do. And of course they can now do that because there are less people around to work because an awful lot have gone back to the rest of Europe, and there is now a huge demand. It's not just lorries, but also just look at, say, the service and leisure sector. Mm. If I go to a restaurant or a pub or something like that, it is immediately noticeable that you have lost probably 25 to 30% of people who would normally be working there. Because they're not available, they've gone back to Europe, or they turn around and said, I'm not prepared to work, frankly, these tiny pay levels, and therefore there are other things I can go and do, because there are lots of other jobs that will be available, and give them more. So the economy has to change. This is an inflection point, not just in Britain, but also actually in certain areas throughout the rest of Europe as well.
Okay, on that note, we'll continue in this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We have co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Urquhart Stewart, and filmmaker and activist Ken Farrow, both of them in London. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Justice in the school of thought of late Muhammad Abdul Hakimi is the absolute justice. Justice for all the world. Justice for human being. So when Allama Hakimi is trying to give this justice, he says that I should drive out this justice from ayat and rivayat.
Maktab Tafkik is holding this wheel that we have to separate between these three. Philosophy, mysticism, and religion, meaning Quran and Ahadith. Okay. So when someone wants to seek the truth, he cannot benefit from the other two approaches, meaning Irfan and philosophy. Because these two school of thought are man-made, and they are subject to errors.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm your host, Atta. Within the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Mahdavi and Shaykh Ziaini. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh Mahdavi, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Ziaini, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to your show, The Teacher.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, we are still talking about the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi. Recently, we missed this outstanding man. August 22nd, 2021 is the day that he passed away. A polymath, a bellatrix, a mujtahid, and a scholar in the field of Quran and Hadith, whose mainly works were concerned with the social reformation and social justice. That's why the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi is called as the thinker or a scholar who is after justice in this society. Sheikh Ziaunia, we know that the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi belongs to a group of thinkers or scholars who are called as Maktab Ma'arifi Khurasan or the Tafkik, we can say a school of thought. Give us some information about this school of thought and the late Hakimi as belonging to this group of people.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Every school of thought is consisted of different scholars and figures. Some are founders of the school of thought and the others are the followers of that school of thought.
That's why.
The late Allama Muhammad Reza Hakimi is the follower of the school of thought of Tafkik. The founder is Ayatollah Mirza Mehdi Isfahani.
That's right.
And you know, the school of thought of Tafkik is a very broad school of thought.
That's right.
Different generations beside different ideas itself. For example, we have some figures in this school of thought that are like late Allama Hakimi,
okay,
that was a friend of late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh.
That's right.
But beside this, friendship, they are having some, differences in their ideas. For example, late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was believing in Irfan, in mysticism, and in philosophy. Late Allama Hakimi was not believing in that, but he was aiding the Islamic revolution
of Iran.
He was aiding even Ayatollah Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh.
That's right.
And when Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was in prison at the era of the king, Pahlavi king, late Allama Hakimi and his teachers, they moved from Mashhad to come to Tehran and want to help Ayatollah Khomeini.
That's right.
So, this is a friendship between them, beside having different ideas. This is a type of scholars in the school of thought of Tafkik.
The peaceful coexistence, yes, that exists between different scholars of Islam. Yes. Okay, very good.
But unfortunately, there are some extremists also in these two different schools of thought. The school of thought of Urafa, that they believe in Irfan and mysticism beside Ahadith and Ayat.
That's right.
And also in the school of thought of Tafkik.
That's right.
That they believe that, okay, we have to only follow Ayat and Rivayat, and we are not allowed to accept Irfan or mysticism or philosophy that is falsafa.
That's right.
So we have to take these issues in consideration and be aware of the subjects like that. That, okay, late Allama Hakimi was a person of Maktab Tafkik.
Yes.
But he was not, giving blasphemy or addressing blasphemous words toward other scholars.
Yes.
So being a Tafkiki person does not mean that, okay, I'm completely against rationalism.
That's right.
No, this is not correct.
Okay.
Being a Tafkiki person is not meaning that I should stand against every figure who believes in philosophy.
That's right.
And be an enemy of him. Mm-hmm. No, this is not the meaning. So if we see that someone or a figure is standing against our scholars who are believing in philosophy and unfortunately in Al-Dawillah are cursing upon them, these issues are extremism in Tafkik.
For sure, the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi was not an extremist.
For sure, yes.
For sure, he was, in the message of the condolence that was given by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, he is referred to as a person who was devoid any type of arrogance or love for this world. At the same time, I think that the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi, as you said, was following his school of thought in which he belonged to, that is Tafkik. But Sheikh Mahtavi, what type of thinking is the Tafkiki type of thinking?
Actually, to respond to this question, we have to say that with respect to different generations of Tafkik, the response is different.
Okay.
For example, when we study the first generation of Tafkiki people, we see the one who has initiated this school of thought, which is Mirza Mahdi Isfahani, he is totally against philosophy and mantiq and logic.
That's right.
So based on his understanding, even one single premises cannot help us with respect to understanding or getting any sort of cognition about the truth and reality.
That's right.
So he's totally against mantiq and falsafe, totally against philosophy and logic.
That's right.
But when we move to the second generation, to which Allama late Muhammad Reza Hakimi belongs, we can say that, as it is mentioned in some of his works, he doesn't have such approach against philosophy and logic. We see that even in some of the works he has introduced, the work Al-Hayat, the rational approach of Islam upon the life.
That's right.
So using this word, rationality,
that's right,
it gives this connotation that the author of the book is not totally against this. And also we have one work, if I'm not mistaken, he is writing in favor of Mullah Sadra. He is trying to defend Mullah Sadra.
That's right.
Although there are a lot of criticism against his work, saying that you are trying to defend Mullah Sadra and it has nothing to do with the way that you are presenting Mullah Sadra school of thought.
Yes.
We see that the second generation of Tafkik, they are not totally against that type of understanding that we can observe in the first generation.
Another sign that he was an intellectual in the true sense of the word is that he wrote some books in commemoration of the figures that might not necessarily belong to his own interest. I mean, for example, he has a commemoration book on Allama Jafari. We know he was after philosophy. Allama Shahid Mutahari, also to the late Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, Allama Sha'rani, Allama Tabatabai, Falaturi, or Sayyid Jalaluddin Ashtiani. These people on whom Allama Hakimi wrote the book and a kind of commemoration belong to the field of philosophy or mysticism. So this shows that he was not at all an extremist.
By the way, they were holding this view that Quran and Hadith are the unique and genius resources from which we can get knowledge and cognition to find out about the truth and reality.
That's all right.
It was one of the principle of his school of thought.
Or pillars of the school of thought. That's all right. Sheikh Ziaynia, so in this way, we have the Quran and Ahadith, but still we have this rationality which must be used under the shadow, or it's better to say under the umbrella of Quran and Hadith. I think it is very much difficult for a scholar to refer only to the Quran and Hadith and deduce the very pure message of them. I mean, it depends on the knowledge and the scholarly character of the researcher too, isn't it?
For sure. You know that if a researcher tries to find out the Islamic ideas throughout the Quran and a Hadith, he has some approaches.
Yes.
He has some fields of study. And with that, you know, previous studies, he is going into the ahadith and ayat to drive out the reasons.
That's right.
And the results.
Okay.
So, because he has some approach, maybe his results also would be different from different person. And this is the, you know, attribute of knowledge.
Yes.
Because we are not infallible. We have some, you know, approaches. We have some tendencies. And if these tendencies are in a way that do not deteriorate us from the right path, I mean,
that's right.
I'm not being biased.
Yes.
If I'm a biased person, I have decided my idea. I have chosen my idea before going into through the ayat and rivayat.
That's right.
But if I'm a person with some approaches, I have no, you know, I'm not biased.
That's right.
I have no judgment before going through the resources.
Yes.
I'm trying to find the truth.
This is what Allama Hakimi called taqaddum ad-din dar ikhtilaf miyan din wa aql. It means when there is a difference between religion and intellect, the priority or preference is with the religion.
This is a very crucial question.
Okay.
Some other scholars, they believe that intellect is not divided from religion.
Okay.
They say, for example, we have some riwayat that they mention that, okay, you have different, you know, gifts from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, some of which is riwayat and ayat, and one of which is intellect. So you cannot divide.
So this is an answer or rebuttal to scholars like Hakimi?
Yes.
Okay.
So those people, those scholars, they believe that intellect is also a gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot say that intellect is out of religion.
That's right. Okay.
So, you know, this question is a very important one, is a very basic question.
Yes.
And I do not think that we may come to the conclusion in a single session because great scholars like late Hakimi, late Allama Tabatabai, late Imam Khomeini, they had argumentation regarding this issue. So this question is very important and very basic.
But I think there is a commonality between all of them. I mean, regarding in the true sense of the word. And that is that they believed in a framework, in a fixed framework, which is the shari'at, I mean, the obligations and the tark of muharramat, or leaving the forbidden ones. Although they might belong to different schools of thought, but they have one commonality, and that is observing and keeping right the basics of the religion of Islam. And this is, I think, very important. Something which is denied by very so-called broad-minded intellectuals of the Islams. I mean, they call themselves secular Muslims or something yes. like that, okay?
Yeah.
So which do not believe in the basics of the religion of Islam, and they try to negate them and deny them.
You know, believing in Sharia yes. or, you know, Ahkam is very important.
Yes.
At the time of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasallatu wasalam, also we had some, you know, different ideas between the companions of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasallatu wasalam. For example, we have Hisham ibn Hakam. He was a figure who was somehow a rationalist.
That's right.
We have some other figures who are not having this approach.
That's right.
Even they have some, you know, I do not want to use the word debate. Even they have some discussions with each other. Okay. But they are sitting around the same table.
That's right.
What is that? Believing in Islam, believing in Quran, and practicing Ahkam.
That's right.
That's why Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam regards and mentions ghulat, those people who were believing in Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam as God, and they were saying that, okay, Ahkam is done by Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
The exaggerators.
Yes.
Yes.
And we are not responsible for Ahkam anymore. We are not responsible to say prayer. We are not responsible to perform fasting, to pay zakat, nothing else. You know, Ahkam and, you know, injunctions of religion are done by Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, and we are their followers, so we will have their intercession in the hereafter.
That's right.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam has called them infidels.
Oh.
So, yes. The exact point that you mentioned,
yes.
All these scholars who are sitting around the table of Islam yes. and are practicing Ahkam and believing in them yes. completely, if they have different approaches, no problem.
Yes.
This is the...
But the rope is safe.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's right. That's all right. So, Sheikh Matavi, any final points?
No specific contribution, but...
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziaynia and Sheikh Matavi, for a nice elaboration regarding the Tafkik school of thoughts. We know that the late... Muhammad Reza Hakimi belongs to this group. They have their own articulations of the beliefs and their approach to the Islamic studies, which is very much respected. But what is important about, I think, the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi is that according to many documents that exist and according to the many messages that have been sent, when you look at the variety of the messages of condolences that were sent for Hakimi, the late Hakimi, you can find that how much he was respected by different schools of thought. From the Maraja in the houses of Qom to the most important broad-minded intellectuals of the world of Islam have respected him and have sent him the message to the leader of Iran, the late Ayatollah Khamenei. I mean, this is the common point that we can find in a character like the late Hakimi. I think this shows something. And that is Hakimi and Hakimi's lifestyle was respected, and the social justice that he was after, the main slogan that he had, was very much respected by all the schools of thought, from among the house students, the house scholars, to the socialists, to the broad-minded people, to the intellectuals of the universities. He was a respectable man and honored and respected by many people. May he rest in peace, and may Allah bless his soul. He was buried in the city of Mashhad, I think in the vicinity of the tomb of Imam al-Ridha in the holy city of Mashhad. May Allah bless his soul. We really miss one of our greatest scholars of contemporary Iran, the late Allama Muhammad Reza Hakimi. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahdavi.
You are most welcome.
And Sheikh Ziaynia.
You are most welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. We again express our condolences on the demise of the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi. To another episode, God bless you. Afi Amanullah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters. British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel and but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really. You know, I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but another fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened. Like, you know, a lot of drivers have gone back home. Like, and hence, there is a shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country, so the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. To clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want a guarantee that they are not left stranded. And if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
A latest study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that difficulties in trade with the UK could put €3.6 billion worth of Made in Italy agri-food exports at risk. Italy's agri-food exports into the UK have already decreased by over 2% since Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed a Brexit trade deal with the EU back in December. Experts say the drop is a direct consequence of Brexit.
From January 1st, Brexit has introduced more bureaucracy, more tax, and a completely new and complex regulatory environment, which have greatly affected the trade volume between the UK and the EU. It must be said that our agri-food products have suffered a drop in trading revenue in Britain only.
The UK ranks fourth among Italy's food and beverage trading partners after Germany, France and the US. Pasta, tomato derivatives, cheese and dairy products are the main Italian export items to the UK. Among other Italian products exported to Britain are transport, clothing, machinery and appliances, and metals. Trade volume between the two countries stood at about €35 billion in 2020, but due to red tape and no tariffs, many are concerned it might drop significantly in the coming months.
We knew full well that Brexit would have had serious consequences. Having said that, Italy's production system is strong. Our high-quality agri-food products are in great demand.
Coldiretti has also expressed concern over the decision by Downing Street to move away from European food standards. This way, Britain risks being flooded with cheaply produced or counterfeit food and drinks. Max Civili, Rome.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days amid the collapse of government and newly settlement of Taliban's emirate, the Islamic Republic of Iran delivers its third round of medical and food aids to Afghanistan. This Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid arrived at Kabul airport on Saturday, containing several tons of rice and other basic food products.
The plane that you see here has brought Iranian aids containing 15 tons of food products. We are here to sort out the aid supplies. We thank neighboring countries that help us in this critical situation and stand by our side after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to bazaar shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aids. Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked and most of us have lost our jobs. We demand neighboring countries to provide us with humanitarian aid.
Afghanistan's economy, which depends on foreign aid, suffered a big loss in the recent change of government. The people of Afghanistan look forward to receiving international aid, calling for an end to sanctions on Afghanistan as soon as possible. They believe that blocking the assets of Afghans by U.S. government puts the people under pressure rather than the Taliban. The United Nations has warned of a looming food crisis in Afghanistan. The UN has also said that its food stocks in the country could run out by the end of September, further pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A number of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers during military raids into different areas in Jenin and northwest of Al-Quds. Three Palestinians were killed near the towns of Beit Anan and Biddu northwest of Al-Quds. The Israeli military said its forces had been tracking a Hamas movement cell for several days and had conducted a wave of operations against the movement across the West Bank and killed Ahmad Zahran, Mahmoud Ahmedan, and Zakaria Badwan, all from Biddu town.
We were shocked by the martyrdom of a number of our sons. We say their blood will pave the way for the Palestinians to go ahead with their fight against the occupation. This is only one part of the Zionist violation against our people.
In the village of Burqin, southwest of Jenin, 16-year-old Yusuf Sabah was killed during the clashes and his body was confiscated by the Israeli forces. 22-year-old Osama Subah was another Palestinian from Burqin killed by Israeli forces. He succumbed to his injuries in a hospital in the city. Palestinian Islamic Jihad later endorsed him as a group member and threatened that black days await Israel in the West Bank and its crimes will only intensify the movement's resistance and unity. Thousands took part in his funeral procession. His wedding was planned for next month, his father told us.
We received the news with utter shock and immense sadness, but no objection. It's Allah's will. Osama's wedding was supposed to be next month, but he was chosen to be martyred.
Two Israeli soldiers were seriously injured during the clashes that broke out between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issued a statement backing the military's operation.
Palestinians say Israel uses lethal force to stem anti-regime resistance in the occupied territories. But they say Tel Aviv will fail to intimidate them into giving up their struggle. Muna Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
September 26 marks the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Journalists, initially declared by the International Federation of Journalists in 1996. To this end, Palestinians held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Youssef Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Youssef has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Youssef. 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security.
During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth. Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Ruva Shabit, Gaza.
This is the second time that the aircraft that belongs to Iran's Mahan Airlines lands here in Kabul International Airport since the beginning of September to deliver tons of humanitarian aids to war-weary Afghans who are experiencing difficult days due to poverty and joblessness.
This is the second time that we have brought some food for the Afghan people. Before the previous time, it was about 25 pounds. 20 tons of food and 5 tons of medicine. This time it is all food.
The flow of humanitarian aid by Iran to Afghanistan is welcomed by all in Afghanistan, saying their country needs more assistance to save the lives of millions of ordinary people who are at risk of hunger and malnutrition. They also believe there must be a transparent process to distribute the aids to most needy ones.
Given that poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan, I think it would be better for donors to first provide food and then pay serious attention to the healthcare sector.
We have been receiving international aid since 2001 during the rule of Karzai and Ghani over Afghanistan, but all to no avail, because poverty is still bothering our people. So my suggestion is that these aids must be distributed first among the most vulnerable, poor and jobless people.
Iran has pledged to continue its support to Afghanistan and its people in different economic, humanitarian, political and security fields. This comes as Taliban takeover in mid-August suddenly changed the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, it also brought some major changes in the policies of some Western states, mainly the U.S. toward Afghanistan, such as freezing Afghanistan's assets. The freeze of Afghanistan's reserves by the U.S. is labeled as an illegal move by Washington against ordinary people. That is why Afghans widely condemn the move and ask why ordinary Afghans should pay the price of Washington's defeat in Afghanistan. However, Afghans look to supportive stances and moves of some neighboring countries like Iran as an example of honesty and true cooperation with Afghans. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Britain is witnessing long queues outside fuel stations, including the capital, London, following fuel rationing
at some distribution centers and temporary closure of many retail stations. British Petroleum said it has closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The multinational gas and oil company blamed the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. The government has cautioned against panic buying, saying there is no shortage at refineries. Britons have, however, paid little heed to the pledge, as long queues of motorists have been forming outside filling stations since Saturday morning. Retailers have warned that the clock is ticking for the government and that it only had just days to prevent a significant disruption in festive preparations in the run-up to Christmas, which is only 3 months away. The administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that it is looking at temporary measures to address the issue. British media said the government is mulling allowing some 5,000 truckers into Britain on short-term work visas in a bid to alleviate the acute labor shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association, however, says Britain needs 100,000 drivers to meet the demand. The UK opposition leader has blasted the government for what he called letting the people down amid the fuel crisis.
We're obviously at a crucial time for the country, and this government is letting people down so badly, whether it's hammering working people on tax and universal credit, whether it's shortages of food and fuel. I've just been up the road, three petrol stations, one of them with a massive queue and two of them with no fuel.
The driver shortage is partly blamed on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which has resulted in tens of thousands of truckers from EU member states leaving the UK. But it has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. The shortage has also set Britain on path for food chaos, since it has led to disruption in deliveries to supermarkets and fast food chains. The fuel issue comes as Britain is also facing a record high surge in natural gas prices, with wholesale prices being up to 250% since January. Experts say households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms are at risk of collapsing. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce.
The United States border with Mexico has witnessed an influx of asylum seekers in recent weeks, with thousands, mostly Haitians, massing there after fleeing poverty in their home country. The migrants reached the Rio Grande after a long, treacherous journey. Images showed people with toddlers staying in squalid tents under a bridge in the Texan border town of Del Rio. But as usual, U.S. authorities began removing and expelling and, in some cases, cracking down on refugees despite criticism at home and abroad. On Thursday, U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in a fiery letter over what he called inhumane expulsions of asylum seekers. The United Nations also demanded an end to the mass expulsion, with UN Refugee Chief calling it inconsistent with international norms. The United Nations Human Rights Office particularly expressed concern over the ill treatment of migrants at the southern U.S. border.
Like, we are disturbed by the images we've seen, and by the fact that we've seen all these migrants and refugees and asylum seekers being transported to Port-au-Prince. We are seriously concerned by the fact that it appears that there has not been any individual assessment on the case.
Condemnations poured in after images showing predominantly white federal agents on horseback whipping and chasing migrants went viral on social media. Human rights groups say such incidents are reminiscent of the disturbing U.S. history of racial and ethnic violence.
The United States has been in existence. It has exploited African people, no matter where African people have been dispersed around the world by Europeans.
The Mexican president, whose country has been the main transit for U.S.-bound migrants, called on his American counterpart to deal with the root cause of the migrant problem. Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged the U.S. to invest in the countries from where migration originates. As the U.S. continues to grapple with the influx of migrants, it remains to be seen whether the Biden administration prevents the crisis